Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and we are closing out the third quarter with an ongoing winning streak of dynamite guests and discussions, and I know it will be in this case because not only is he a hero of mine, an economic legend, but he's also a repeat guest on Capitol Record, and he's never let us down before. I have no reason to think the winning streak will break today. I'm referring to Dr. Art Laffer. For those of you who are not familiar with Dr. Laffer, we welcome you to your first year of life on planet Earth. And for those of you who are familiar, you know the great contributions he has made to economic thought and serving in an advisory capacity to so many, not only in the political realm, but the broader academic and economic realm. He's had a tremendous impact on my life, my thinking, and many others that you would know as well. More importantly, we enjoy talking with one another, and we've been sitting here doing it without hitting record, and then we decided we may as well bring our discussion to you all. So the record has hit, and I want to welcome Dr. Art Laffer back to National Review's Capitol Record.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure being with you, as always.
So, Art, there's so much going on in the world right now, and I'm going to start with kind of the easiest, broadest conversation about the economy. What do you think about the state of the economy as we sit here in March of 2024?
Well, we've seen all the numbers coming in, and you know the numbers. I'll go up a little bit. Inflation has been really bad for the last 3 or 4 years under Biden. The latest numbers do not show a cessation of inflation, far from it. Prices are up something like 18 or 19% since Biden took office. If you look at a lot of the transfer payments that have been done by this administration, they've convinced people not to work. So you find a huge reduction in the labor force, which has led to a very low unemployment rate, but it's also led to a very low participation rate as people have left. You see the economy in all sorts of areas is underperforming my view of the world. And so that's where we are. What really bothers me, David, if I can put it into a nutshell, are the economic issues. And I wanted to touch on two of them with you and then maybe broaden it. Transfer payments are really a disastrous policy set for a country. A transfer payment is when you take from someone and give it to someone else. It can be from tall people to short people, from fat people to skinny people, old people to young people, all these different ones. We usually think of it in terms of income redistribution, where you take from those who have a little bit more and you give to those who have a little bit less. That's the way we usually think of income redistribution or transfer payments. And I'm going to use that as the example here because it's not Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, left wing or right wing. This is just plain economics. It's math. It's not your opinion. It's math. Whenever you take from someone who has a little bit more, you reduce that person's incentives to produce, and that person will produce a little bit less. Whenever you give to someone who has a little bit less, you provide that person with an alternative source of income, David, other than working, and that person too will produce a little bit less. The theorem here, and this is just plain economics, is whenever you redistribute income, you always reduce total income, period. That's math, and it's just plain math. It doesn't matter from whom to whom, you always reduce total income. And the lemma from this theorem is sort of neat. I'm not going to prove it verbally for you like I did the theorem itself, but let me just describe the lemma, which is the more you redistribute, the greater will be the reduction in total income. And I think that's pretty obvious, but it's true. So you have, whenever you redistribute income, you always reduce total income. The more you redistribute, the greater will be the drop in total income. And the limit function from this theorem, I find, is delicious and with a pecan flavor, a little garlic on it. It has all the deliciousness of life itself. The limit theorem here, the limit theorem here is very, very simple. If you were able to redistribute income so that everyone came out exactly the same, if you were able to do that, there would be no income whatsoever. Period. There'd be zero income. And let me prove that to you verbally again. You know, in order to get to redistribute income completely so that everyone comes out exactly the same, what you'd have to do, David, is you'd have to tax everyone above the average income 100% of the excess. And you'd have to subsidize everyone below the average income 100% of the difference to get everyone to come out exactly the same. Now, if you actually did that, if you actually taxed everyone above the average income 100% of the excess, and if you actually did subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income 100%, I will stipulate today, counselor, that we'll all come out equal at no income whatsoever. And this is the theorem. This is where good economics taught at a university or taught even in a high school or even taught by mom at 7-year-old kid is so critical, is that redistribution causes a loss in total income. The more you redistribute, the greater will be the loss in total income. And the limit function, I wish Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and these others could hear this, but the limit function is you came into a society that has complete equality of income. I will guarantee you there will be no income whatsoever, period. You know, and when you look at this world, you know, all political revolutions have always been fought on how to redistribute income. None of them have been successful. But they all have been successful in destroying income, but never in redistributing income. They just are not successful. And that's where we are today in this world. We've gone through a huge period of radical transformation of how we think about economics since I was a young economist to today, all of it focusing around redistribution by age, by sex, by race, by income distribution, all of this stuff. And it's done nothing but lower growth rates and make the U.S. less and less successful, and ruining the future for all sorts of people who are here and who would like to have an opportunity to do well. And you live in one of the states that does it really well. You guys go bonkers on redistributing income.
Well, and so myself as a dual citizen of New York and California, I'm a byproduct of both the states that probably participate in such redistributionist schemes more than anyone else. I think, you know, the way you set it up is brilliant. It is somewhat inarguable. There is a math theorem to it that is algebraic and identifiable. It generates two questions. First, a quick comment. When you say redistribution can be from a tall person to a skinny, to a short person, a fat person to a skinny person, or someone of some means to someone of less means, it could also be the same person three times, which apparently is what you're talking about.
Exactly. No, that too. Even if you destroy, if you tax it from you and give it back to you, it'll destroy income. This is the problem with Tabor in Colorado. Yeah. Is they overtax and then they give it back in tax rebates, which ruins income just like anything else. You got to do it in lowering tax rates, not in tax rebates. And that's why I was so much against the Tabor. Well, the initiative we did would be to force them to lower rates, but the voters didn't like that. They like their Christmas checks.
So the historical argument for the supply side movement centered around incentives, just like you just did in making an argument against redistribution as being holistically corrosive of total income.
Exactly.
But it seems that a lot of the expression of the argument focused on the equally cogent mathematical point that top marginal tax rates erode, the higher the rate, the less incentive, and the lower the rate, the more incentive.
Yep.
I don't recall the argument in the late 70s and early 80s being directly connected to what was done with that money, where when you talk about redistribution, you're now attaching it to the use of funds.
Yep.
is redistribution more disincentivizing for income than just simply the higher marginal rate they use to pay for it?
Yeah, let me go back and take you back to my conversations with the president and with Jack Kemp and some of the others back in the day before you were even born, David. And, you know, I told the president, I said, there are two areas in the U.S. economy where tax rates are excruciatingly high. One is on the highest income earners, where we had up to 91%, I think it was, or whatever it was back in 78. It wasn't 91%. It was 70% then.
But then it was 70%.
Yeah, it was 70% then. But I said also in the lowest, in the inner city dwellers, we have something called the welfare poverty trap, which if people show initiative, drive, et cetera, and increase their incomes, the more they increase their incomes, of course, the less welfare they get. The less welfare you get, this is a huge disincentive for work. And this is the poverty trap. I did that. And I think it was when I moved to California in 1976, I was a columnist for the LA Times. So I did it for the inner city poverty trap in LA and Watts. I did it there. We did something called enterprise zones, which I got Jack Kemp to go for. And it got Reagan to go for them as well, both sides of it. So it was well known back then, both on the top and on the bottom, you had these huge negative incentive situations, just like the transfer theorem I described. But since then, I think it's only Casey Mulligan lately who really is focused on the inner city and the disincentive effects of government spending as much. If you pay people not to work and tax them if they do work, Do I need to say the next sentence to you?
Well, I think,
yeah.
I mean, I think that is the obvious takeaway. But I would point out that, in theory, the redistribution doesn't have to only include paying people not to work and the sort of either.
Oh, no, it doesn't. You're right.
And that's where my second question was coming from is, you know, the welfare critique. You're right. Jack Kemp cared about this subject. Daniel Patrick Moynihan on the Democrat side cared about this subject. But when you get past the welfare reform that had a work requirement that Gingrich and President Clinton passed, it doesn't seem that we talk about the inner city a lot anymore. And yet redistribution seems to have taken on a lot of new forms besides inner city poverty.
Oh, yeah, program. Totally.
I wonder if you think the same economic principles, when you talk about a math theorem, apply to corporate welfare like the CHIPS Act.
Yes, of course it does. It does the CHIPS Act. It does even to CHIPRA, which is the dental portion of the CHIPS Act. You're talking about the CHIPS Act, the CHIPS
semiconductor.
I'm sorry, I thought you were calling about CHIPRA. The health.
Oh, no, I know what you're referring to. I know. Yeah, I'm even just saying
it does the
corporate welfare. It's still redistribution, right? It comes from
a
tax base.
Totally. You're completely correct. It reduces output, employment, production, and income, no matter from whom, who it is you take from or whom it is to whom you give. It still reduces it just the same. And you can see it very easily. I mean, imagine a person who works at Walmart as a greeter at the front door, and you give that person a transfer payment, you know, a once and for all transfer payment of $100,000, the first thing that guy's going to do is quit his job, go out there and, you know, try to find his bucket list, try and help his friends, treat his friends to a pizza or whatever it is. This is the whole thing of the government spending side, which is the negative side that has been so damaging under Biden. It was very much so as well once COVID hit. Once COVID hit, everyone wanted to do the spending. But, you know, it's continued under Biden, and it's caused this huge lack of wanting to go to work on the part of groups of people. And, you know, once they stop working for a year or two, they lose the skills. And then
excessive spending under Biden, which you and I would be equally critical of, and you mentioned the COVID era, I could let it go, but I know I'm going to get flack from people thinking that I'm being a coward if I don't. You don't think it's fair to say that the spending was excessive in 17, 18, and 19 as well before COVID?
Of course it was.
Okay.
Of course it was. And let me just tell you, then COVID it was too.
Yeah.
I never would have done that spending. As you may remember, David, I was the one who proposed the having a payroll tax waiver for a year or two, which would have put the same in, but it would have been in a very pro-growth, pro-employment sense, as opposed to paying people not to work.
Let's tell listeners what you're talking about.
Yeah, instead of doing the $2.5 trillion of stimulus spending that was done when COVID hit, starting in, I think, March or April of 2020, and it lasted all the way through a good chunk of Biden, the beginning couple of years of Biden's presidency. Instead of doing that, we should have done the same amount of money, but only make it, instead of a spending program, make it a get rid of a welfare program, of a tax program. So what I would have done is I would suspend the payroll tax, both employer and employee, for 2 years to really incentivize people to produce as much as they possibly could and still get the same amount of net funds into the system.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
So people have an idea of what Dr. Laffer's talking about. I think a lot of you know that you have 6.2% that comes out of your paycheck for Social Security. Your employer pays 6.2%, and then there's another 2.9% for Medicare. It's 15.3%.
Yes, sir.
12.4% of that caps at, I think, $140,000. The 2.9% for Medicare doesn't cap. It continues to go and go and go. So what you're talking about is a 15% savings, broad-based, across the entire payroll of the economy that Dr. Laffer was proposing versus something that was a giveaway, a transfer payment to businesses that may not have needed it, that they may have, PPP, they were told, it's your patriotic duty to go take a forgivable loan. And so what you got was a total lack of any supply side incentive. You just simply sloshed money around. Some of it was needed and put to good use. Some of it may have saved a few restaurants and hotels here and there. Ironically, it wasn't even nearly targeted enough to restaurants and hotels who you could argue were the biggest victims of COVID policy. But your basic idea here was textbook supply side, because it provided incentives on the margin.
Yep, that's it. And you know what I proposed in 2007, 2008 was we have a federal tax holiday for a year and a half. So there would be no federal taxes, no income taxes, no payroll taxes, employer employee, no Medicare, Medicaid taxes, no taxes, what's their death taxes, no capital gains taxes, no taxes, federal taxes for a year and a half, which would have been the exact same size as the stimulus package in 2007, 2008. And can you imagine what we would have had happen in this country if we'd have had no federal taxes whatsoever? I mean, we would have been selling cars into central China, for goodness sakes. I mean, we would have had this hyper heart attack model of a growth and expansion. And instead of going into a deep recession, depression, which we did, the Great Recession, we would have had the great boom of all time.
I would argue, by the way, that not only would that have done exactly what you just said, but even if they only did the capital gain portion of it, I don't think people realize how much we destroy capital formation by the fear of a tax on realizing capital gains, where a holiday there that would have enabled people to sell overvalued homes so they could reallocate resources to a more opportunistic part of the economy.
Exactly.
And they wouldn't do it because of the tax disincentive to doing so. And we really have struggled with a lack of adequate, not only capital formation, but just allocating resources to more productive use.
Exactly.
It hasn't quite been Japan-like, but it's in the same genre for over a decade now.
It is. There's one other area that has hit me lately, David, if you want to talk about it, is monetary policy. As you know, my original career was always money with Bob Mundell, and I did the Mundell-Laffer hypothesis and all of that. Something very unusual is happening today in the monetary sphere. And let me, if I can, describe it. Now, everyone talks about how strong the dollar is, and In some sense, that's true. It's stronger than the pound or the euro or the Japanese yen or the renminbi or any of these others. But in that arena, it's the tallest midget of the bunch. When you look at the dollar today, it's about as weak as it's ever been. The price level is up 19%, which means relative to goods and services, it has declined dramatically. Relative to gold, gold is now at 2120, 2150. I don't know what the number is today. You probably do. Dollar is very, very weak relative to relative to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies and all that. What you are seeing is a very interesting rejection of the U.S. monetary system. The U.S. dollar, which had been private up until 1913, until the Fed came into existence. Dollars were pre-created by banks, and all these were banknotes and all of that. Now, the federal government did define what a dollar was, David. It was 1/20th of an ounce of gold or 1 ounce of silver. That's true, but that was just defining what it was. The federal government also did mint coins. If you brought in silver or gold, it minted these coins, but so did everyone else. There were lots of mints around that were not government-run mints, and the banks really created money. And for 200 years up until 1913, the price level basically remained constant for two centuries. No aggregate inflation or deflation. Once you put it in control of the government with 1913, the Fed, then you go to 1933, the Bank Holiday Act under Roosevelt, which devalued the dollar from $20.67 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Then you started seeing the inflation coming. Then you see it with Smithsonian Accord. And I'm missing a lot of other fun stuff there, like the interest equalization tax, the voluntary foreign credit restraint program, and all this. I think if you look at all of this stuff, the price level from 1913 to the present, and I may be wrong, I haven't looked at the numbers at all lately, but I think it's gone up like 22 or 30 fold. And what you are finding now is a private sector trying to find some way of getting around the federal control of money and creating a private money. And that is where I see Bitcoin and some of these other cryptocurrencies is literally the attempts by the private sector to circumvent government money and having it. I've got a trip coming down fairly soon to El Salvador where the president has just allowed Bitcoin to be circulated as a currency of the realm down there, which is sort of interesting. Bukele is his name. But it's interesting how that is. I think what you're seeing is another major transition of private sector creation of money to replace government money. And that is equally as well as the transfer theorem, one of the most exciting things. Bad monies are, it's called, what is it called? The monetary theorem. I can't remember it now. I'm getting old. But it's where bad money drives out good. And that's exactly what you're seeing right now. And both of them are exciting.
I've had a couple guests on this subject in the last couple months. I admit I'm on a little different side on whether or not I think crypto and Bitcoin represents that solution. I'm not on a different side than you, that we're in desperate need of monetary credibility, a sound dollar. I think you're going to find your trip to El Salvador fascinating for how that experiment is going thus far. Zeke Fox from Bloomberg just wrote a book about this, and he went down to El Salvador.
I love it.
Yeah, and he was quite intrigued by how much the El Salvadorians are asking to stop this. But I think that there's a lot that is TBD. But if we can focus on the part we agree on. I think that the Fed being anointed as the arbiter of the economy has been an unmitigated disaster.
Totally.
I believe the idea that we advocate for price discovery in everything we do in the economy, more or less, except for the price of money, is absurd.
I agree.
The price of credit being fixed by the central bank, I think,
makes no sense.
And it essentially creates exponentially more challenge at price discovery, because what is more important to getting a price than the price of the capital that is driving goods and services?
Exactly. So,
It's a crazy time we live in. You know, I was with David Malpass last week in D.C., former president of the World Bank. We did a panel together at Amity Schley's Coolidge Foundation event. And you and I had a lot of good friends who were there. He's advocating for this idea that I find totally intriguing when you talk about government spending, which, of course, is largely driven by transfer payments out of control, of saying that at a certain breach of debt to GDP ratio, Congress doesn't get paid, benefits don't, you know, that they can't hire staffers, they don't get bonuses, that you make it really, really hurt, not just on an annual budget level, because they have ways to get around that every year, but on a debt to GDP ratio. What is your thought on something like that?
You know, I love those thoughts, but they're so impractical, David. I mean, you're not going to get the same people who are going to be voting against them getting their pay to vote for it. Come on. Now, I would like
to. Isn't that also true of a balanced budget amendment then, that you're never going to get that either?
Yeah, a balanced budget amendment never works. It never works. It doesn't work in any state that I've ever heard of. It doesn't work at the federal level. The state and local debt's huge, as you know, because they can borrow all they want. What I would like to do is twist it. Let me put it in a more positive sense. I would like to put politicians on commission. Now, this is a different model than Malpass is there. If, for example, let's say the GDP growth is 3%, you get your pay. GDP growth is 4%, you get double your pay. GDP growth is 5%, you get triple your pay. GDP growth is 2%, you don't get your pay. GDP growth is 1%, you have to pay the government back. Give them the positive incentives. There's a chance. There's just a chance that they might think that they can make a killing and therefore pass it. And then you get both the positive and the negative discipline. I'd like to reward them for doing well as punish them for doing badly. Did you follow my difference? I think David's a pie in the sky idea. I love it. I mean, we all do, but that will never happen. But merit pay for politicians. You know very well every politician who gets elected and takes office never dies poor. They never die poor. The question is, how do they make their money? Do they make it corruptly, or do they make it by doing a good job? And if you put them all on commission, you would see them voting very, very differently than they do today. And you might even get that bill passed, the commission bill. I don't mind them making a lot of money as long as I do too.
I think that you brought this idea up the first time you're on the podcast, and I spent a little time thinking about it. And of course, conceptually, you have converted me at a very young age to understanding economics through the framework of incentives. And I like the idea. I do believe incentives have to cut both ways. I don't like commissions when there isn't pain.
I don't either.
And you're talking about negative incentives, not only upside. The only little problem I have, and I want to hear you push back on my pushback, is that it's so, when we talk about a commission on GDP, do any of us really believe? I believe Congress has the ability to damage GDP. I don't believe they have a lot of ability to grow GDP, other than by removing impediments.
Well, that's
right?
Huge.
But you know, but see, I'm worried about the implicit message, which is also something that bothers me with the executive branch to no end. Every single thing that happens in the economy, we say the president did it. If it's good, it's the Biden economy. If there's a bad inflation number, it's Biden inflation. True. And it's all BS. And then the other side will do it when there's a guy they don't like. And I just am worried about this federalizing of the economy to say that Congress gets a commission for the economy. Is there a way to target it to what they actually can control? You know, things like spending, they have power of the purse. GDP growth, I would like to think that entrepreneurs and small business and Fortune 500 and, you know, Wall Street, private equity, that's driving economic growth. We just need Congress to get the hell out of the way.
Yeah, I too agree with you. But, you know, the more complicated you make the model, the more likely it's going to be done around, you know, the first two pages of the tax codes describe incomes and tax rates, period. And the next, I think, next 84 volumes describe all the exceptions. And, you know, what I like to do is keep it simple so that these guys can at least see a method of how they can do well. Now, with Reagan, we had an old phrase, don't just stand there, undo something. As long as we've got an economy that's as badly controlled as it is today, I don't really worry about the commissions not working in both directions. If we were in the Elysian fields of perfectness, you know, I would agree with you. There's very little that Congress can do to make the economy grow faster. There's a lot they can do to make it grow slower. I do agree with you. By the way, and I want to go back and correct one thing, not from you, but from me. I don't disagree with you that the Bitcoin might not be the correct route through that. I don't know these different currencies, these different things. All I'm saying is I do believe the phenomenon of cryptocurrencies is being stoked very, very heavily by the bad performance of the U.S. dollar and the bad performance of currencies around the world. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that Bitcoin is the answer, although it may be. I don't know.
And so when you look at the need for more price stability, and we look at the heavy level of spending, when you look at the depleted GDP growth since the Great Recession, basically working at our real GDP rate at about 50% of its post-war average.
Yeah.
Do you believe that the excessive size of government relative to GDP has been the predominant factor? Do you think there's something else that has put downward pressure on growth and
productivity?
Totally.
It's just the downward factor of government. And, you know, what we do is you and I talk about the federal government. But when you look at state governments, if you look at property taxes, if you look at in 1932, local governments spent twice as much as federal and state combined. Property taxes and local government spending is enormous, and it's extraordinarily inefficient. There's no tax, I think, on earth that is more dysfunctional than the property tax. It is a wealth tax, and it causes enormous declines in wealth for a very simple transfer of a couple thousand bucks. And I could take you through that. I don't think we have time today in that, but I could take you through that. But property taxes are as bad a killer as anything I know in society today. And then you get these people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, a lot of others who want a wealth tax federally as well, which is just crazy stuff.
A lot of people have said, just for our national audience, California passed Prop 32 in 2012. I will add that they also passed it retroactively, meaning 6 weeks before the end of the year, it was to become the law for the entire 365 days of that year, where the top rate went to 13.3%. That is a higher marginal state income rate than any state in the country, including Manhattan, with the city tax, where it caps out at 12.9%. Also perverse, but nevertheless 40 basis points less than California's top rate. And a lot of people have said over the years, I am shocked that Californians have put up with these high tax rates. Even the middle income earners are paying very, very high state rates. Well, we now see that California's population has declined, which is an unheard of phenomena in the history of our great union. You have the greatest weather in the country. That with culture, with history, with sightseeing, with jobs, with opportunity, with technology, and yet you have basically Louisiana, Mississippi, and California as the three states that are losing people. Meanwhile, states like Idaho and Utah are up 10%, and states like Arizona, Texas, Florida up 4 or 5%. So California has gone negative, but a lot of people thought it could be worse. But I want to point out that California had a 13.3% state rate and the property tax burdens that New York, New Jersey, Connecticut have, you'd have 50 million people leave the state.
Yes.
You'd have an avalanche of ex-migration. And the reason they don't is because of Art Laffer and the great Howard Jarvis people of 1978 that passed Prop 13. Art, explain how Prop 13 has held the line limit that burdensome wealth tax.
Let me do with the one side of Prop 13, which is the property tax. Prop 13 limits property tax rates to never exceed 1% of market value. That's the ceiling. It got rid of all of the differences in property. There is no longer residential and farm and industrial and commercial and all that, which every other state has. California has one property tax. That's it. And it can never exceed 1%. In addition to that, David, the constitutional amendment had that property tax rates for any one owner can never increase by more than 2% per annum. So the longer you own a property, assuming that that property is appreciating, the lower your property tax rate is. I think today, property tax rates in California are about 0.58%, whereas the rest of the nation, they're much higher than that, much, much higher. And that would be just residential. They're higher, much, much, much higher if you can consider commercial and industrial as well.
I think the way you just said it may confuse people because what he means is 0.5, 0.8, where you're taking the tax people are paying divided by the market value.
Yes, that's right.
It's 1% at 1% at purchase price.
Yep.
Then it can only escalate 2% a year. So how does that get to 0.5 or 0.8?
Well, what happens is your house price doubles. Your house price doubles or triples.
The house is a lot more than the tax goes up.
Yeah. And so your effective tax rate is much, much less than that. And that's exactly what happens in there. And, you know, when we did Prop 13, I think the effective rate before 13 was 2.6 or 2.8%. In one day, it went from 2.6, 2.8 to 1%. That's a 60% drop in that tax rate. Bang. By 14 months later, property tax revenues were back up to where they had been before. You saw the unemployment rate in California went from 2.5% above the national average to a little bit below it. You found property values, which had been, median home prices have been right in the level of and the average of the nation. Within 10 years, they were way more than double the nation property. It was the biggest period of prosperity ever in California. California grew in that decade by a Massachusetts. It grew by a San Francisco per year. We were the fastest growing state. All of the poverty measures dropped. It was just fantastic performance. And that's what happened. Now, we also have some very pro-property tax laws. For example, there are no taxes levied, federal, state, or local, on unrealized capital gains. So if your house price doubles, you don't have to pay taxes on that doubling unless you sell it. But even if you do sell it, you get very preferential treatment because for a couple, it's $500, $1,000 per year exemption. Every 2 years, you get exemption. For an individual, it's $250,000 just for residential homes. You also get something at death, which if you don't sell your house and it comes to death, you get something called a step-up basis, which your house price goes there with no capital gains tax at death. So property is extremely beneficially treated in California. And the reason California is doing as well as it is, and by the way, while they are losing lots and lots and lots of people, you would expect them to lose a lot more people. And the reason they aren't is because of this breathing hole that is called Prop 13 that has really saved California from becoming West Virginia. And it is the role model that every state should follow, David, on property taxes. Many states, like if you look at inside Detroit, property tax rates are 28%. In some of the areas of Detroit. In Cleveland, they're 3, 4, 5%. You can't, Hartford, Bridgeport, you've got property tax rates of 5%+, and they're both cities bankrupt. In Tennessee, where I am, the highest property tax rates are in Memphis, which is the only area of Tennessee not performing well. It's just a catastrophe, and I can do on and on and on. And I've got a couple of papers that I'd love to send you, and if you'd like, on property taxes. It's my next book's coming out is a state how-to manual of how to fix your state and really make it go. One is the income tax, of course. Then we have ghost taxes like transparency, like enterprise zones, like other things like we talked about. But then also one is property tax reform, which is really important for state and local governments to follow through to really create prosperity.
Well, I could not possibly agree more. I think you're exactly right. That was the point I was making. If people think this recent migration out of California is something, they just have no idea how bad it would be if it weren't for Prop 13.
Exactly.
And it's really amazing how good we're so used to bad legislation that you can't get rid of. You can't get rid of Obamacare very easily. We can't get rid of so much of what was done in the Great Society and the New Deal. But, you know, sometimes good legislation is hard to get rid of, too. and yes, Prop 13 in California, and even the fact that our national conversation about about marginal income rates, you know, we debate between 33% and 39%, and I prefer lower and flatter, and so do you. But we're not going back to talking about 70%. We're not going back to talking about 91%. You know, we're in a different world now. The totally. Good legislation kind of helped recenter that conversation.
You're totally right. You know, the highest marginal income tax rate in 1945 was 94%. You know, in 1978, only one state did not have a death tax, an individual state death tax. Today, like 33 states have gotten rid of their death tax, the inventory tax, right to work. You look at all of these things, the federal tax rate. We have made huge progress, David, and we're just beginning. When I hit 137, which is when I think I'm going to get close to being old enough to die, we're going to change this world to be free market, pro-growth, democratic economic capitalism like you've never seen. And I'm really excited.
I can't wait for it. I believe you. I believe it's going to happen. Art, I appreciate your time as always. It's a provocative conversation. The commission model in Congress, the general discussion about the dollar, and of course, the never-ending reinforcement. You know, I just hope everyone listening understands. You could re-listen to this whole podcast. You're not going to find Art talking about lower tax rates for any other reason than how the lower rates increase incentives to grow productivity. It's economic growth driven. It's more jobs, it's more wages, it's more profits, it's a higher quality of life. This idea that we want lower taxes because we like rich people better is a straw man argument. What we like is more people having a chance to become rich men and rich
women.
That's
right.
That's what we want.
Thank you, David. I'd love to
Always
see
a
you
pleasure,
in that. Love to see you in Nashville someday soon.
Yes. Well, I didn't get to see you here my last visit, but I'll be back real soon. Our office there is flourishing, as you can imagine. It's amazing what happens when states do good work. I know you're happy there, and we'll get together next time I'm in town, Art.
I'd love it. Thank you, David.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.